Okay, thanks. So I guess we're off to a little bit of a slow start this morning, but anyway, those of you who are here get to listen to a proof. So what I want to do today is, first of all, to prove the criterion or the equivalence of the two statement definitions I gave for quantifier elimination, and then I'll use that test to prove that the quantifier elimination for a real closed ordered field. All right, so first of all, let me remind you that the statement so the following are equivalent. We have a T in theory. And the first statement says, for every models M, N of T, and A, a common substructure, for every formula phi of x and every a that we might put in for the x, m satisfies the formula phi of a if and only if n satisfies the formula phi of a. So that's our model theoretic test for quantifier elimination. And the second statement is for every formula phi of x, there is a quantifier-free formula theta of x such that for all models, M of T, it's true in M that for all X, phi of X holds if and only if theta of X holds. So that's our statement that the theory has quantifier elimination. So the proof in one direction, the proof that two implies one, is pretty straightforward, so I won't go into that. Basically, quantifier-free formulas pass from redux and substructures, so there's no issue really with that. So the interesting and the complicated direction is one implies two. And this is really a very kind of paradigm example of how we use the compactness theorem and how, in particular, the compactness theorem doesn't give us any constructive content. It doesn't tell us what the formula it is. It just says we can find it in some way or other. So first of all, we just deal with a preliminary case. So I can fix my formula that I'm interested in. So I fix some formula phi, and I just need to find a quantifier-free quantifier-free formula theta, which is equivalent to phi. So just to get rid of the trivial case, if this formula happens to be true in T, if T tells us that for all x, phi of x, then we just put, we take C to be the formula C equals C, where C is this constant symbol that I have floating around in the language, and if T satisfies for all x, not phi of x, then I'll put theta to be the formula C is not equal to C, and so that gets rid of that, those cases. So now we can assume that we have both T union phi of x and T union not phi of x are both satisfiable. So the theory T is not deciding whether phi of x is true or not. Okay, so what we want to do is to find a quantifier-free formula which is equivalent to phi. So in order to start doing that, I'm going to look at all potential candidates for such a formula. That is, I'll look at all quantifier-free formula for which phi implies psi and see whether out of those I can find one which gives the implication the other way. So in order to do that, first of all, I kind of need to get rid of this x as a variable. So I'll add constant symbols to the language to stand for the variable symbols in x. So we'll add. Right, so probably I should do this one line above. All right, so let's add constant symbols. C1 to Cn, where n is the same length as I have x1 to xn. And as Matthias says, probably I should have done that back there, and then I should say phi of C and phi of C, so that those are theories, which are then satisfiable or not. Okay, so then let me look at the following collection of formulas, and then I'll make them into sentences. So let's take delta of x to be, I'll call it delta of c. Delta of c to be the set of formulae psi of c, such that psi is quantifier free, and it's true in the theory that phi of c implies psi of c. So I'm collecting together all the quantifier-free formulae which are implied by phi. Okay, so then I need a claim. Claim one. This is the board that doesn't stay up. So claim one is, let me get this right. For any model M of T and any A in M, which I'm going to use to interpret the C's, if M is a model for the theory of T along with delta, all the formulae delta with the A's put in for the constant symbol C, then also M is a model for the formula phi with the same constant symbols. Okay, so it's consistent that I would have either phi of A or not phi of A when I have T, but this says no. In fact, if I put in all these formulae delta, then I have to get phi as well. Okay, so we need to prove this claim. So we'll do it by contradiction. So suppose not. Then that would mean that I have some model, M, for T union delta of A, but M model is not phi of A. So then there is some model, M model for T, a model for delta of A, but in M, I know that not phi of A. Okay, so in this model M, let me take the, and I there is an M and there is a sequence A which interprets the constant symbols in M. I have to have an M in order to have the A, so that's kind of why I have to do this step. So let me now take the substructure, which is generated by these A's. So let A be the substructure generated by the elements A. And now I have a subclaim. Well, it was claim one. This is subclaim. There is a model N of T with A a substructure of N, and N satisfies phi at A. Okay, so this is my, I've got my M. I use the model M to get A, and now I'm looking at A, and I'm saying if I start with A and look up, I can find a model of which A is a substructure and in which the formula phi is true. So we'll prove the subclaim. So what? There doesn't seem to be any way to make this proof have less built-in subsidiary negations. Well, if this is not true, if the subclaim is not true, then that says that for every model which contains A as a substructure, the formula not phi is true. So in every model, which contains A as a substructure, phi of A does not hold. Is that the way I don't want to say it? In other words, what this is saying is I can write down a theory which does not have, which is not satisfiable. So the theory T, and then I need to say that A is contained as a substructure. So to do that, what I'll say is that everything that I might say about A in a quantifier-free way is true in there. So I'll throw in all the formulae psi of A with the property that this A as a substructure in A, psi of A holds, and psi is quantifier free. And then I'll put in the formula phi of A. And what I just said is that there is no model for this theory. This theory says that any model of this theory would be a model of T. It would be a model of every quantifier-free statement about A. In other words, A would be a substructure. And phi of A would hold in such a model. And I just said above that I don't have such a thing. There is no such model. So this theory is not satisfiable. Well, if the theory is not satisfiable, then by the compactness theorem, it's finitely not satisfiable. So by compactness, there is a finite subset and now I can pick that finite subset where I want. Well, in a way, I know that T is consistent with phi of A, so I can make sure that that inconsistency is sitting in this collection of formulae. So I'll take it out of there. So there's a finite subset, psi 1 up to some psi k, from this set of formulae, the quantifier-free formula which tell me about A, which give me the lack of satisfiability, so that is such that for every model, N of T, this model says that if I have the psi's, then I don't have phi. So in the model N, if I have all of these psi's, then I don't have phi. Well, I could also write that equivalently. That says that in the model N, it's true that if I have phi, then I don't have one of the psi sub i's. I don't have. Okay, but these psi's are quantifier-free formulae, which are in delta. Let's see, why are they in delta? Yes. Yes, that's right. So the psi's in fact are in delta, and in M, which is a model of T union delta of A, I know that phi implies all the psi's. So that's a contradiction, because this right here, I said for every model N of T, this will be true, but my original M, where I said in the beginning of the proof of the claim one, said that M is a model which contradicts this. So, but in M, which is a model of T, we know that in M it's true that phi of A implies all the psi's, in particular this finite list of psi sub I, and so that M gives me a contradiction. Okay, so that contradiction proves the subclaim. So thus, the subclaim holds. So I have some model which contains A as a substructure in which phi of A is true. But I originally said I had some model which as model of T, contains A as a substructure in which not phi of A is true. Right, so now I have M and N, both models of T, A is substructure of both of them. And I have M says that not phi of A, and N says that phi of A holds, and this is a contradiction with my assumption of 1. All right, so that proves the subclaim, I mean the claim, claim 1. That proves claim 1. So anytime I take a model of T and all of delta of A, then in fact it also has to be a model of this formula phi of A. And now I just need to know that in fact, therefore, one of the elements from delta of A implies phi. But that we just get by compactness. So claim 2, there are finitely many psi 1 through psi k in delta such that for any model M of T and any A in M, it's true in M that the conjunction of the psi sub I at A imply phi at A. Okay, so the proof of claim 2, again, suppose not. So if there are not slightly many psi sub i's in delta, and which have this property, then that means that the theory which has t and all of delta and, well, let me write it down, then the theory t union delta, by the constants, union the formula not phi of c, is finitely satisfiable. All right, let's just stare at that one for a moment. If I take any finite collection from the deltas, those finitely many deltas cannot imply phi of a. There will be some model in which I have those psi's and I don't have phi of a, which is precisely saying that this set is finitely satisfiable. But if it's finitely satisfiable, then it's satisfiable. Hence, satisfiable. But that says that there's a model of t and delta of c in which not phi is true. But that contradicts claim 1. Claim 1 said that all models of t and delta of c also have phi holding. So this contradicts. So then my formula that I'm trying to get, theta, is of course the conjunction of the psi sub i's. So that's the proof. Now you can see that the actual process of getting the finitely many, getting the quantifier-free formula requires, in particular, this application of the compactness theorem, which doesn't tell us how to get them or where they are. Okay, so just one more comment about this statement, this equivalence, is that we can also make it a bit simpler by observing that, in fact, I don't need to do this for every formula. I only need to do it for formulas of a particularly simple form. I can do it just for formulas which have just one existential quantifier. And then, so I can restate this as saying, for every M and N model of T, A a common substructure, for every formula of the form, there exists Y such that psi of X, Y, where Y is a single variable, then M models phi of A, that is, there is a value, there is a B, there exists a Y such that phi of A Y, if and only if in N there exists a Y such that, sorry, I called it psi of A Y. Okay, so I just have to be able to realize one existential quantifier in each model. And then similarly for the statement here, although maybe I should leave that out, I mean, I could also simplify this one to being just one existential quantifier and then build from that to the, that's just a simple argument on complexity of formulae, just the way they built up to just go from eliminating one existential quantifier to eliminating any quantifier. Okay, so now what I want to do is to use this model theoretic test to show how to eliminate quantifiers in the real, so for a real closed field. So before I start that, I want to be a little bit more precise. I'm more precise than I was yesterday about what I mean by the context in which we're working. So just for definition. So first of all, a field F is said to be formally real if -1 is not a sum of squares. In the field. So then what that gives us is if I have a field which is formally real, then I can put an ordering on it which is compatible with the field structure. So if F is formally real, in fact, if and only if, F is formally real, if and only if there is an ordering on F compatible with the field structure. Okay, so then I can define a real closed field. So F is real closed if it's formally real and no algebraic extension is formally real. Okay, so real closed is it's as big as it can be while maintaining the property of having an ordering. Now, the way I've written that, it doesn't look like it's a first order property. Right? To say that no algebraic extension, I have to refer to all possible algebraic extensions, and I can't do that in a first order way. But we can rewrite that condition into one which is first order. Well, yeah, okay. So both of them look like they're not exactly the way I've stated it. It looks like it's not first order. But we can find a way of writing it down so that it is. So it's really a theorem which says the theory RCF of real closed fields has the following axioms. Okay, and I guess the theorem is that then a particular field is real closed if and only if it's a model for these axioms. So first of all, we have to say all of the field axioms. I won't write those down. We have to say that the field is formally real, so I have to say in some way that minus 1 is not a sum of squares. And the way I'll say that is by writing down infinitely many axioms which say minus 1 is not a sum of n squares. And then I just take all of those axioms, and that gives me an infinite list of axioms. So this is for n greater than or equal to 1, and then I'll say for all x1 through xn, the sum of the xi squared, I equals 1 to n, plus 1, is not equal to 0. Okay, then each one says minus 1 is not a sum of n squares, and then all of them together say minus 1 is not a sum of squares at all. I'll need to say that every positive element has a square root. And we can, of course, notice I'm doing this in the language without an ordering. This is the theory of real closed fields. I should emphasize this is in the language of rings. For all x, there exists a y such that either y squared is equal to x or y squared plus x is equal to 0. So either x or minus x has a square root. And 4, again, I need to say this condition that no algebraic extension is formally real. well, let's these two together to say that the you have square roots of all positive elements as part of that. And then the other one we want to say is that every odd degree polynomial has a root. So again, I have to do a infinite list of axioms to say that. I'll say that every polynomial of degree 2n plus 1 has a root. And then I have infinitely many axioms for all n. So I'll have for all x1 to x sub 2n, there exists a y such that y to the 2n plus 1 plus the sum of xi y to the I is equal to 0. So there exists a y which is a solution to that polynomial equation. Okay, so then if I have such a list of axioms, if I have a field which satisfies those axioms, so then it's a real closed field, then it has a unique ordering. And the ordering is given in the way that it should be. So any real closed field has a unique ordering. Given by x is less than y, if and only if y minus x is positive, that is, there exists a z such that z squared is equal to y minus x. And any ordered field has a unique algebraic extension which is real closed. Which is real closed. Right, so if I have a real closed field, then I can put an ordering on it in a unique way. If I have a field which already has an ordering, then I can find a unique algebraic extension which is real closed. But if I have a field which is only formally real field, it potentially has many different orderings. And so I don't get the uniqueness because I can put an ordering on in different ways and then I get different real closures. So, okay. Yep. Thanks. So I can write down the theory of, so if I move into a language in which I put in the ordering, and so that insists that when I take a field, I specify its ordering at the same time, and so I don't have this problem of potentially different orderings, then I'll call that the field theory of real closed ordered fields. And this is, so in the language of ordered rings, and then this is the theory of real closed fields plus the axiom which says precisely that, for all x and for all y, x is less than y if and only if there exists a non-zero z such that z squared equals y minus x. So that gives me the additional axiom that I need to make sure that my orderings are compatible. Okay, so then the theorem is that this theory, the theory of real closed ordered fields, has quantifier elimination. Okay, so I want to use this version of the quantifier elimination test. So I need to take two models of the theory. Well, it's 6 M and N, a model of the theory, a common substructure, and it's useful, first of all, to know what this tells us about A, that it's a common substructure in this language. We know that it's a structure for the language, so it has an addition and a multiplication, it has a 0 and a 1, it has an ordering. And we also know that any quantifier, any atomic formula, which is true in either M or N, has to be true in A. So that tells us all sorts of things, like it's an integral domain, that the ordering is respecting the operations of addition and multiplication, because those are all things which are true in M and N, and which lift down to A. So we can immediately say that A is an ordered integral domain. And remember that sort of from the example from last time, this is exactly why we need to put the ordering in, so that we know that it's the same order. We already know that A is ordered and has the same ordering in both M and N. Now, if I have an ordered integral domain, there's only one way to extend the ordering and to extend the addition and multiplication to its quotient field. So again, I don't have a choice of how the elements of the language are defined if I go from A up to its quotient field. So everything is there is uniquely defined. There's no way of making things behave differently in M versus in N. So I can lift to the quotient field immediately. So in fact, we may assume that A is a field. Okay, so in fact it's an ordered field. Okay, so what we're trying to do, we're given a formula of the form there exists y is such that psi of xy. So we're given a formula psi of xy, where y is just a single variable, and some parameters A from A, and we need to show that if this formula is true in M, then it's true in M, in N. So that is, we need to show if there is some B in M such that the formula holds, such that M tells us that psi of A, B holds, then also then there is B prime in N with the same thing, such that in N it's true that psi of A, B prime. So we've got to, if we know we can find a B in M, then we need to be able to find one in N. Okay, so to do this, we need to look a little bit more carefully at the formula, at what the formula can actually say. But it also helps to make one more observation, which is that from this statement here, we know that any ordered field has a unique algebraic extension, which is real closed. So if I look at this field A, I know it has a unique real closure. So what that means is if I look at its real closure in the direction of M, or if I look at the real closure in the direction of N, those two things are isomorphic. And to be isomorphic means in particular that if I can find, if I know that such a formula psi, which is telling me something about the structure as a real closed field, is true in M, then it's true in N as well. So the point I'm making here is that if I can find such a B in M and it happens to be in the algebraic closure, then I already have it in N. All right, so if B is in the real closure of A in the direction of M, then so the real closure of A and M, let's call this the real closure R1 of A and M. And R2 is the real closure of A in N. Well, then we know that these things are isomorphic. Then there is sigma from R1 to R2, which is an ordered field isomorphism. So if psi of AB holds an M, then psi of A and sigma of B holds an M. So if I can actually find this point B in which is algebraic over A, then I already know that I can find the point that I need. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yes. All right. Yes. Did I not say that? Yes, C is quantifier free, because I needed to get down to just a one existential quantifier. Yeah. Okay, so that's good, because then if I can find a B which is algebraic over A, then I already know that I can find my B prime, because that will be sigma of B. All right, so now let's consider this formula. So we may as well assume, just for convenience, that in fact A is already real closed. Okay, because if I have to go up to the algebraic closure, that's fine. Algebraic closure inside of M, then I know I can map it over. All right, so now let's actually see what the structure of this formula psi might be. And this, by the way, is kind of the way all of these proofs go. That is, you need to understand what it means to be a substructure. You need to know something, some kind of algebraic fact about the situation in which you're working. And then you need to sort of go into it and say, well, what does the formula actually say? All right, so in our situation, we have our C of XY. It's, I put in the parameters A from capital A, and we need to say, what can it say? Well, it's a quantifier-free formula involving terms. The terms that we can build in this language with addition and multiplication are polynomials with coefficients, which are listed amongst the A. So the terms are polynomials let's say P of Y. The things that we can say about them in the atomic language, in atomic formula, is that P of Y is equal to zero, or we could say that P of Y is less than zero. I can get rid of negated atomic formulas, because if I have a formula which says it's not the case that P of Y is equal to zero, well, this is equivalent in the theory to saying that either P of Y is less than zero or minus P of Y is less than zero, so I can get rid of those, and similarly for not P of Y less than zero. And then I'm really just working with formulas of this form, and then I build them up using the logical connectives, and the logical connectives I can actually simplify to write it in what we call disjunctive normal form. So I can write in disjunctive normal form, that means that we just take we put all the disjuncts together, and then we have a conjunction of all those disjuncts. So in disjunctive normal form, my formula is a, oh, it's the other way around. So my psi is a disjunction of, so that's a bunch of ors, of formulae of the form P1 of y is equal to 0 and Pk of y is equal to 0 and Q1 of y is less than 0 and QL of y is less than 0. So now I just have this bunch of formulae written out like this. In order to satisfy the disjunction, I only need to satisfy one of them, so I can assume I have just one. And I can get rid of this, which is a little bit ugly, because, again, in a real closed field, the P1 is equal to 0 and Pk is equal to 0 is equivalent to saying that the sum of the Pi squared is equal to 0. So I can assume I have just one polynomial equals 0. So after all this, I've got it down to the point where I can assume that my formula says has one conjunct of the form P of y is equal to 0, and then I have a bunch of other polynomials, Q of y is less than 0, and QL of y is less than 0. Now I have two cases. Case one, P is a non-trivial polynomial. So in that case, when I'm saying that I have a B which makes this, which satisfies this formula, so then if we know that psi of AB is true in M, then in particular, we know that P of B is equal to 0. So B is algebraic over A. In fact, therefore it's in A, because we assumed that A was real closed. So B is in A, and so B is in A, so I don't have anything else to do. B is already in N. So case two is that we can assume P is trivial, and we may assume that B is not algebraic. Well, not algebraic over A. In particular, it's not in A. Otherwise, I don't have anything to do. So now I've got to the point where I have these polynomials Q1 through QL, and I know that they at B, all of them are negative. Well, now I guess I need to know something else about a real closed field, which is that if I have a polynomial, it can only change sign at a zero, and so I have finitely many zeros which are algebraic over A. So each Q sub I only changes sign at elements of A. So, and I know I have this point B at which all of the polynomials are negative, so I can find for each of the polynomials there will be an interval which on which it's negative and which contains B. So there are C1 through CL, D1 to DL, such that CI is less than B is less than DI, and my polynomial Q sub I of X has constant sign negative on the interval for all X in the interval from CI to DI. So now I can take C to be the maximum of the C sub I, D to be the minimum of the D sub I, and I know that B has to be in this interval C is less than B, is less than B. So in particular, this interval is non-empty. So the interval from C to D is non-empty in a M. Now I have a non-empty interval in M, and I will look at that over in N, because the ordering is dense. In fact, there has to be an element in that interval. In fact, it has to be in A.
So
what
will C and D belong to A, right?
Yes. All the CIs are in A, because I assume the A's algebraic. Now, algebraically closed, so it's real closed. So I get the C's, again, yeah, exactly. The interval from C to D is non-empty, but it's also, its endpoints are in A. So, really, because the ordering is dense, I know that there is a B prime in the interval from C to D with B prime in A, and so therefore in particular in N. Yeah. Okay, so then I'm done. And I think I'll stop.